Unsere Empfehlung für deinen Podcast? Frisches Obst und knackiges Gemüse von Aldi. Immer günstig und natürlich mit dem Aldi-Tiefpreisversprechen. Zum Beispiel knackiges Gemüse, saftiges Obst, frische Backwaren. Kurz gesagt, mehr Frische für alle. Entdecke jetzt viele weitere Angebote zum Tiefpreis in deiner Aldi-Nord-Filiale. Und weiter geht's. Einfach lauschen und genießen. Aldi. Gutes für alle.
Welcome to another episode of Axe the Blood God, US Gamer's official RPG podcast. I am your host, Kat Bailey, and joining me as always is nobody, because Nadia is on vacation, and I don't have another guest. However, we do have Mike and Katie coming on a little bit later to be talking about what we want from next-gen RPGs, and it's a really good conversation. We just wrapped it up. We talk a lot about what we are expecting from the genre, what we wouldn't mind seeing from things like AI, how it can get past some of the baseline conventions like the need for combat. If you enjoy the show, can I recommend that you leave us a review over on iTunes or the podcatcher of your choice? It definitely helps with the visibility of the podcast. Also, follow me on Twitter at @the_catbot. Nadia is @NadiaOxford. And follow our other podcast hosted by Jeff Green. It's called Branching Narratives. And I had a really cool conversation with Jeff Green where we talked about his career and working his way through the games industry. And he has a lot of great old stories about working in print. We have a newsletter that comes out every single Wednesday. I handled it this week. And I touched on a topic that has been talked about on this podcast in the past. That is, can Fable and Avowed carry the Xbox Series X? I think that with RPGs being more popular than ever, I mean, all you have to do is look at the popularity of games like Skyrim, the fact that Aiden Chronicles was just fully funded for $2.5 million shows that there is a lot of heat and a lot of passion around really good RPGs. People love the interactivity. They love the amount of game that's involved. They love getting lost in these giant fantasy worlds. And Fable and Avowed have an opportunity to really push that envelope and become kind of the flagship games that Xbox needs. If you want to get our newsletter that comes every single Wednesday, just go over to the website and subscribe, and it will show up in your mailbox with a cool little sword emoji to kind of differentiate it. Every newsletter contains some thoughts from Nadia and myself, as well as all of the headlines from the latest newsletter. Before we continue on to the main topic, let's continue on to some of the news. The biggest piece of news right now, outside of Aiden Chronicle being fully funded and having a fishing minigame, I'm very excited about that, is that Moon, the 1997 PlayStation role-playing game, is coming to Nintendo Switch on August 27th, fully localized. It's the game's first official release in English. It was designed by Yoshiro Kimura, and it has been called an anti-RPG. According to Polygon, Moon addresses the bizarre behaviors of many RPG heroes who rudely enter people's homes in search of items and clues, and who slay thousands of creatures for items and experience, and adds a bit of a playful twist. Players do not assume the role of the traditional hero, but that of a boy who is sucked into his television and into an in-game RPG called Moon World. The boy follows the hero's adventures, freeing the soul of slain enemies and collecting a resource called love. Tim Rogers helped with the localization. Tim Rogers is a friend of this podcast. We're going to have him on later in August so that he can talk about Moon. The other piece of RPG news? No, World of Warcraft is not coming to console. You know, I was thinking about this. I would not mind seeing World of Warcraft on something like, you guessed it, Nintendo Switch. Why wouldn't I mind playing WoW on Nintendo Switch? I guess that I sort of see WoW, despite all of the time spent raiding and everything, as almost a casual RPG. It is a game that could translate readily to a handheld scenario on Nintendo Switch. It's pretty old at this point. There's a huge amount of content to chew through. And frankly, the graphics are dated enough that I sort of feel weird playing it on a PC, but maybe playing it on Nintendo Switch wouldn't be as jarring. It seemingly is not coming to console, and it's staying firmly on PC. Blizzard disavowed that it is under development. So, too bad. I guess we are seeing a little bit of a missed opportunity. Okay, that is our RPG news. Thanks for listening. We're going to continue onward to the main topic. Don't go away. All right, I'm here with Katie McCarthy, senior editor.
Hello, I'm glad to be back, as always.
And Mike Williams, reviews editor.
Hello, hello, folks. How's everybody doing today?
And yeah, we're going to be talking about a topic that we kind of meant to get to in the last episode, but got completely derailed by all of the RPG news and Aid and Chronicle getting announced and everything. And that is, how can RPGs be better in the next generation? And it's been a question that's kind of been weighing on my mind. And I know that we have new frontiers, but what are those new frontiers? Where can we go from here? Because it felt like this generation was kind of a lot about refinement, you know?
No, I definitely agree. Like the one RPG, or I mean, obviously the few RPGs that stand out is like Witcher 3, obviously, which was very much like a refinement on like open world RPGs and expanded that. And then there's like Disco Elysium, which was probably the only RPG that I feel like broke new ground this year, perhaps, like not this year, but like this generation, but also is a PC exclusive game so far, so maybe it's not indicative of like where console RPGs are headed.
Yeah, I see, Witcher 3 is a good one because I enjoy the Witcher 3, but I don't think the Witcher 3 technically from a game standpoint does anything particularly amazing or new. I think where they really sold it was on the storytelling aspects.
Mm-hmm.
Their storytelling was to a higher level than most other studios. For me, other than Disco Elysium, which, yes, as you point out, is probably one of the most interesting mechanical changes this generation, what I did enjoy were studios like InXile and Larian revisiting the old CRPG style of game that sort of got lost because BioWare, like back in the day, was the CRPG like lead, and then they sort of trended towards more cinematic games that sort of in some places lost their RPG-ness because as your presentation improves, sometimes the number of directions you can go, the amount of dialogue you can add, and all that stuff gets lessened. So I think BioWare probably lost something, and when BioWare lost that, I think a lot of other RPG developers sort of moved away from that as well. So to see that come back with some B-level studios that are getting to A-level now has been, I think, a boon. Like, that's still refinement, but I think it's a good thing to sort of go back and bring that idea forward.
Yeah, and I feel like there's kind of almost three types of pop, like in terms of like popular mainstream RPGs. There's like the like CRPG type, which we've been seeing with like PC focused studios. We've seen like a lot of action RPGs this generation, obviously. I feel like every AAA game is like an RPG in some respects, like Assassin's Creed's an RPG series now. And then we have like typical turn-based JRPGs, but also like even JRPGs are going action now, or like have been going action for like this generation. So it's I mean, I can't think of an action JRPG that I like. I guess Nier Automata, but I don't like Nier Automata for the combat.
Kingdom Hearts 3, a good review, Katie. Never
I know
forget.
I did. I still like that game, but I definitely scored it too high, and I also reviewed it in like 48 hours, so it was also like I was not sleeping, so maybe that skewed it, definitely, but and I feel like I mean, Kingdom Hearts 3 had the best combat of the series, I think. Like, it like added a lot of variety to it. Like, there's like projectile type keyblades where you basically had like dual pistols, and that was like kind of a fun new thing, but I mean, it's still like a pretty easy combat system, like all things considered.
I think FF7 Remake really did a great job of squaring it, you know, mm-hmm. being able to have that really crunchy tactical element that was a lot of fun and appealed to turn-based people like me, but also having that exciting kind of really kinetic action feel to it. And I really hope that certain RPGs, if they have to go action, go in that direction.
Of like the JRPGs of this generation, like Final Fantasy VII Remake, I feel like probably has the best combat that I can think of immediately. I mean, there's I think of Persona 5 as having great combat where it's like turn-based, but it's very active and it's not like a lot of like, oh, I'm like waiting a long time to make a decision, but it's not like an active time battle system. It's still turn-based ultimately. And then Final Fantasy 7 Remake, I feel like kind of does the opposite thing where it's like, it's an action combat system, but it also slows things down so you can like make those tactical decisions. So it's kind of like both those games in a way are kind of blending the two, like, I guess, design philosophies in a way. Like, they're both, like, there's room for both action and, like, tactical, more turn-based type stuff. And those, I feel like, stand out as, like, RPGs that really, like, messed with, like, the typical battle systems that we know in a fresh way.
Yeah, I my only problem with FF7, which I enjoyed that battle system a great deal, were more tweaks. One, I enjoyed the battles more where it leaned further on the weakness style system, like where you needed to really use that in order to get past the fight. And two, the party AI was just like bad, like very bad. I have no idea what they were doing. Like, look, if I'm not controlling like Tifa or Barrett, please let them actually do something. Like, I need them to be building ATB meter while I'm not using them.
Yeah, that's definitely an annoying thing. And I've switched a lot. Like, I was definitely like very active with that system where it's like every time there's an ATB meter up, I was like, okay, now I'm this. But I was like, whenever Tifa was in my party, I was like dominantly her because she was just very fun to play as. But yeah, the AI was definitely lacking in Final Fantasy VII Remake, and that's something I hope in part two that they fix, because I feel like that was a pretty common criticism. I feel like a lot of people kind of had that same sentiment of this AI, this party AI can be better, but also it's like trying to encourage you to swap between characters. So it was like successful in that respect, but also, yeah, it definitely was lacking.
Yeah, and then there's the third rung is the Octopath Traveler, Bravely Default to
Aiden Chronicle.
Aiden Chronicle. Like the much like the CRPG at the beginning of this generation went through, it's like, let's go back and take that old thing and bring it forward. I think we're hopefully gonna start seeing more of that, where Japanese developers or even Western developers, I know Zoboid Games is doing another RPG, this time based on Magical Girl stuff. But like bringing back that old straightforward turn-based game, maybe upgrading the graphics a bit, but not going like entirely to the Final Fantasy VII's remakes of the world.
I'm kind of excited for the new game by the folks from The Messenger. Where you have the two characters, it's almost sort of an isometric look, and it's incorporating both turn-based and action elements into its battle system. You'll forgive me if I think it's called Sea of Stars or something to that effect.
Yes, and it looks fantastic. Yes, Sabotage Studio doing, I think it's Sea of Stars. I'd have to check to make sure the name, but it is like Sea of something.
Yeah, I am really intrigued by that game, and I hope that it speaks to a greater push by indie developers to be able to do more RPGs in the next generation, because there certainly have been indie RPGs, but I feel like in a lot of ways it's such a big sprawling genre, the cost-benefit ratio isn't exactly there for small teams that are having to generate a ton of content. But as the tools become more refined and it becomes easier to generate stuff, and the appetite for these big, meaty RPG experiences remains very strong, I wouldn't be surprised if you see more indie developers in the next generation leaning into especially 16-bit nostalgia for their RPGs. And frankly, 16-bit RPGs hold up really well, so I wouldn't be upset, you know, Katie?
Yeah, I mean, I was not a fan of Octopath Traveler. Like, I did
neither
not
was
like
I actually I hope Aiden Chronicles is way better.
Yeah, and it has like a great look to it. Like, I love the art style they're going with. Like, definitely, I mean, they've directly cited Octopath, right? So it's
the overworld's good, the battle not so good.
Yeah exactly. It's like,
it looks like a mobile game.
Yeah, it's and there's too much bloom filter. Like, they way overdid it there, and there's like good like art direction there, but I mean, the battle system just wasn't good to me. It was just battles took so long. Like,
by the
so
way, Blood
long.
God fans are coming for you because we're dissing Octopath Traveler. Can't
yeah,
do that.
The battles are so
I thought
long.
It was so good. That was actually essentially like a Final Fantasy VII is sort of like a lesser version of that. Like, not as stringent. And I really liked it. Yes, battles did take too long. So
long.
I would tweak
like
that.
Just like random battles would take forever, and it was that I think that's what got me. It's like, I don't mind if like a boss battle takes a while. Like, I kind of assume that going into a boss battle, but when like your random encounters take like 20 minutes a piece, that's ridiculous. I don't know. Maybe that's just me, and I value my time too much or something. But
so I want to circle back to Disco Elysium really quickly. You guys were talking about how it was one of the only RPGs to truly push the format. And I'm curious, what is the one thing from Disco Elysium that we kind of want to carry over into the next generation for bigger budget games to adopt?
I mean, I think it's just like the sheer amount of choice and like character shaping. And like, I mean, there's so much in that game. Like,
you're constantly making little choices, right?
It's like a purely dialogue-based system. Like, there's no combat in Disco Elysium, so it's pretty much you're only having conversations. But literally, like, every little choice you're making is influencing, like, your stats and everything. And, like, how you build your character in the beginning kind of determines how, like, later conversations play out, how relationships play out. Like, you can completely lock yourself out some content. But it's very replayable in that sense also. So I feel like what I'd love to see more RPGs do, or like big budget AAA RPGs do, is just like really make those choices matter. Because I feel like The Witcher 3 has like choices obviously that matter, but it does feel very binary in a sense. Whereas Disco Elysium, like, it never felt binary. It felt like I was literally just role-playing. Like, I was just shaping this character. I was going through the story. I was learning about this world. And another thing I think that sticks out is Disco Elysium is like a very unique setting. It's not post-apocalyptic. It's not sci-fi. I guess it's sort of post-apocalyptic, but not in like a traditional way. It's just very distinct. It's a very distinct game. The writing is really, really good. Like, still excellent. Like, I still just like randomly think about moments in that game like all the time, which I can't say that about honestly any game of like this past like generation whatsoever.
It's weird that we don't have more noir RPGs.
Yeah.
We have so many fantasy and sci-fi RPGs, but noir, so many elements of noir that you can adopt into RPGs. It feels like a weird oversight that we look at a game like Disco Elysium and go, oh, not many games like that.
I mean, it's more than just like a noir like detective game, though. It's like it has like this really striking setting, this like really rich history. Like, there's like a whole history to like Rachel, I think is how you pronounce it. And there's like a whole like little, not sci-fi, but there's like a mystery, like mystic element to it too, to the world. And there's just so much going on in that game, and it all works. Like, that's the shocking thing, is like the whole game works. Like, it's kind of a miracle that it all clicks together. But I mean, maybe the writers coming from like an actual like authorial like book background helps, maybe, because they're used to actually like writing. Maybe that's why it stands out so much, is that it's just like a much richer world than we're used to in any video game.
I would say part of the problem surrounding the Disco Elysium talk, there are things I really enjoyed about Disco Elysium that sort of set it apart. including things like the Thought Cabinet, where sort of ideas about who you are as a character have to sort of, you have to add them and then sort of reinforce them and let them coalesce over time. I really like that. In terms of smaller choices and world building, like, I think Divinity does to that level of sort of bringing over the D&D straight up style RPG thing to games. It works in that same space. But I think Divinity tends to be a little bit more hardcore because of the combat side of the experience, whereas Disco Elysium is a little bit more, there is combat, but that it's very combat light. Like, there's not necessarily a combat system per se. You're just making a choice that happens to involve an attempt at punching someone,
yeah,
or something
like damaging
like that.
Your morale or something. Like, right. Like, at one point, I had like made myself sad, so I took damage because I had made myself sad because I had, like, I was being too self-deprecating, I think. So there's little things like that that are really great. But yeah, so it's like, yeah, you have a health meter and you have, I think it's called the morale meter. I don't know. There's like two different health meters basically, and if they drop to zero, you then can die, which is weird, but there's no like violent. I mean, there's like, yeah, there's like instances where of like punching someone or something, but there's no like, okay, I'm gonna go equip my gun and go into this battle. Whereas like the thing with Divinity is it's like a big systems heavy combat system. Like, everything can kind of interact with one another, so that definitely lends itself more to like an RPG setting of, okay, like, we need to go through this dungeon. How are we gonna do it? Are we gonna like spill whatever and light it on fire, you know, that sort of thing.
And I think the character side, like the character and story parts of Divinity, are equally deep in the amount of choices that you can bring forward and really role play your characters. But the combat being, it's very hardcore, is a high barrier for many people. And I think really with Disco Elysium, one of the things that people should bring forward is, like, don't be afraid to try, like, cut out systems. Like, not having a combat system isn't necessarily a negative if you build the game around it. And not being able to just say, drop a point into, I'm going to be a superstar cop, really, like, changes how you make some of those decisions. Like, yes, you can add it, but then you got to wait for it to really firm up and become a part of your character. And that's an interesting idea. So, I mean, what I want from Disco Elysium is for developers to be like, do we really need like a combat system? Do we really need the dialogue system to be the BioWare standard? How much of an overworld do we need? And I feel like developers rarely play around with RPGs like that, with the exception of Kawazu-san, who does the Saga games, which I think sometimes are a little bit too esoteric.
Well, it's something that goes all the way back to Ultima 4, right? Where Richard Garriott was kind of going, well, I mean, all the bad guys are dead, and people have been complaining about how violent these games are. I mean, what if I make this game about choices that you make and regaining all the virtues and not being a jerk, and that becomes a unique sort of role-playing experience? I feel like Disco Elysium kind of is very much in that tradition, but at the same time, we get stuck into this headspace of, well, of course an RPG has to have combat. We lean super hard into the dungeon-crawling roots that go all the way back to classic D&D. So it's natural to kind of stuck in this binary element of RPG design. But I completely agree with Mike when he says that maybe next gen, we start to see developers finding ways to do lots of really meaningful role-playing and incorporating tons of interesting systems into the dialogue without actually having traditional combat. And that makes me really excited, actually.
Yeah, like one of the barriers for me for like getting into like Fallout or even like Elder Scrolls, even though I've played a lot of Elder Scrolls, is that I don't like the combat in those games. Like just plain and simple. Like I just like I like imagine like what if Fallout New Vegas had no combat? Like I could probably play that game and like it, you know? Like I really don't like the combat in most open world RPGs.
The combat's by far the weakest part of Fallout New Vegas.
Exactly. So it's like, imagine like a AAA developer making like this gigantic, super, like, I guess this would be a super buzzwordy thing, but like immersive type world, you know, with their budget. But what if they just skip combat? What if just like there's no gun? You're not shooting people. You're just, you know, you're role playing. Maybe you're building up like a base or something, or like a town, or I guess that's kind of Sigurdin-esque, but
kind of simulation-esque. Suddenly you've got Stardew Valley.
Yeah, but like I feel like there's space to play around with in RPGs, where like as we see in Disco Elysium, and even like to an extent in Larian Studios games, where it's you don't have to just do like running around and shooting at monsters in between all the actual stuff that people like to do in your RPGs. Like there's more that can be played with.
So stretching the meaning of a role-playing game, having different professions, finding ways to incorporate role-playing mechanics into a game that could be one part, I don't know, Disco Elysium and one part job simulator, where you're in a cubicle and you're getting through all your work and you're interacting with your coworkers and you're building up your stats, but there's no combat, quote-unquote.
Yeah, see, like right there, an RPG based in office, bam, that's an interesting idea. Like navigating, maybe working your way up the totem pole over like the course of multiple days or weeks or whatever. Like that's a cool. And like only like one of my favorite ideas probably of the, not this generation that's passed, but the past one was Alpha Protocol, which was an, I have been dying for somebody, anybody to do an espionage RPG. Like, you don't even need combat. In fact, you can, if you do a espionage RPG right, maybe there shouldn't be any combat at all, because you're not a very good spy if you're always doing the James Bond firefight thing. But
so
yeah,
a real spy RPG where you're making relationships and you're slowly but surely building this crazy identity, and you could even make it something along the lines of, maybe the identity starts to overtake your character and they find themselves sympathizing with the people that they're supposed to be spying on. And maybe there's a crucial decision where you decide whether or not to betray your organization and things like that. And you're coming up with really devious ways to perpetrate your spycraft. You can do the Americans, but without the action and with a lot more spycraft.
Right. And see, right there, you bring that pitch to the games press and influencers. I think that goes a lot further than here's a spy-ish RPG, here's a turn-based combat system, and you can make BioWare style choices here and here. Like I don't think that's as interesting or sellable as like what you just described there.
I think that there's still a huge appetite for traditional RPGs, though. Yeah. As evidenced by the fact that Larian has managed to appear, and they've made a lot of hay just on using turn-based combat. They are defiantly an old-school turn-based combat studio, and I super applaud them for that. But they also play around with turn-based combat systems and have a lot of fun with that aspect. I wouldn't mind seeing developers continue to make games in the traditional RPG mold, but have way more reactive worlds, way more reactive systems. Not having everything being scripted, but being able to incorporate AI in some way, maybe even this might get me into trouble because I might sound like I have no idea what I'm talking about. Is there some way that machine learning can be used to create truly reactive worlds that start to produce dialogue and characters and situations and quests on the fly in a truly interesting world? Is this a thing that we can see in like 10 years?
Ken Levine. Wasn't he working on something like this? Like what he was describing when he said something like that. something near the idea of an immersive sim, but built in a world that can react to you a little bit more.
Yeah, I think he actually pitched that at GDC like 6 years ago.
Yeah, and then we haven't, like, he's still at 2K doing something at his little studio that we have not heard of since then.
Since he killed his other studio and lost a lot of people their jobs?
Right.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, don't get me started on that.
Awkward.
So yeah, like maybe something like that. Like I think there's room out there to have a little bit more fun with it. Like, go out there and do something interesting.
Yeah, I'm almost imagining a situation where you know how in Left 4 Dead you have kind of an unseen GM or AI person who's constantly sending in zombies depending on the situation and changing things up? I'm almost imagining an AI dungeon master who, in real life, you would have a person, a really good DM, would see what the characters are doing and be able to craft situations on the fly and potentially send the story in really interesting directions. If we could have an AI version of that, it could, in a way, be really old school, but at the same time, be kind of revolutionary for how we understand and experience RPGs.
Yeah. And I mean, developers will need to start thinking of this because creating graphic assets is getting way more expensive, and what you're getting out of it is probably not as beneficial.
That's interesting because Ubisoft claims that the actual cost of creating assets and things has been somewhat flat, especially heading into the next generation.
Maybe. I could see that, especially if they're still working for PC. But, like, pushing the graphics too far forward is no longer as useful because, like, even pondering talking about the fact that the new technology in the PS5 and Series X is not mirrored over in PCs. So if you're making a multi-platform game, you can't really use all of those new features. And then you add the Switch into it, which is such an important platform for a lot of indie developers. And I think maybe the graphics race might slow down a bit to sort of like a mid ground where we are in this, and maybe developers playing around with art styles a little bit more too, which might help. Like, if you're aiming for a lower or medium spec, perhaps you can do some more interesting things with it.
We've talked a lot about what we want to see from RPGs going into the next generation. We've talked about more reactive worlds and having jobs and settings that wouldn't necessarily be within your typical fantasy or space molds. We talked about doing away with baseline concepts like combat systems. But what do we think RPGs will actually look like in the next gen? And this is where I'm going to be really cynical and say that I think a lot of people are going to try and ape The Witcher next gen. And we're already seeing it, but I think it's going to be even more so.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like we are already seeing that. Like, that's basically what new Assassin's Creed is. It's like they took heavy inspiration from The Witcher, and it works for the most part. Like, I don't think Odyssey's main story was as good as Origins. Like, Origins is more compelling, like, top to bottom for me, but 100% were influenced by The Witcher. And I feel like even in, like, Ghost of Tsushima, you can see some witchery influence in the side quests in terms of, like, how they're plotted and how they have, like, multiple steps and everything.
Oh, absolutely. And like, I almost think that Tsushima side quests are probably like real strong, actually, stories. Yeah. Overall.
Lady Masako.
Oh yes, like that like top to bottom from beginning, like it started off a little one note and then as you kept going, like,
yeah,
that was almost Witcher level as a side quest to me.
I think she's just like good, like a well-written character. Like, I feel like we don't see many like women portrayed that way in games, you know? Like, she's like flawed, she's grieving for her whole family, she's on like a quest for revenge, but then she like shows compassion in unexpected ways. Like, I feel like that was like that I'm not finished with the game. I'm still in Act 2, but for me, like, so far it's been the highlight of the game, like, just her journey. And also, like, I think it's Ishikawa, the, like, samurai
sensei, who's,
like, his, like, student, like, defected to, like, the Mongol side, and there's, like, this whole drama with that, and there's, like, a lot of restraint in that story because you, like, never see her until, like, pretty deep in the quest line. You just kind of, like, hear, like, you get, like, bits of the story farther along, and then you kind of start doubting, like, Ishikawa's side, like, okay, like, is he telling the whole truth here? Like, what happened? What did he do that made her defect? I still haven't finished that quest line, so I don't know the whole ending there, but you definitely, like, we're already seeing The Witcher 3's influence in modern open world games in general, because, I mean, The Witcher 3 kind of set a new standard for open world storytelling. It showed that, like, it didn't have to all just be fetch quests, and it didn't have to all just be, you know, go to this place and kill this amount of people, and there could be more depth to that, but also, like,
the scale of the world and the beauty
scale
of
the world and how it feels, like, bustling and alive. And, I mean, it also influenced it to a detriment. Like, we are also seeing so many of the Witcher systems in, like, every game. Like, Detective Vision. I guess that was a Batman thing before.
That was a Batman thing.
Witcher.
Yeah.
But, I mean, Witcher did it also in that
and Tsushima.
In that space. And Tsushima. Yeah, it's exactly. But it's, like, Detective Vision is in every open world game. Like, Assassin's Creed has it. Like, it's everywhere. And that's something I would like to see ditched in next gen, but
yeah, we're doing a whole article about this, actually.
Yes, we are, but I don't think it's gonna go away, but I would like to see it go away.
Well, I mean, if you don't mind me ranting briefly, it's such a cliche easy shortcut of, like, having the character go, oh, blood, there's a fight here, and then walking
I'm gonna
along
these
the trail
footprints.
Of footsteps,
yeah.
And you're like, yeah, it's so perfunctory, there's no real interaction to it.
Like, at least in Witcher, it kind of makes sense because he's, like, he has cat-like powers, you know? Like, he can sense stuff. But, like, in every other game, it's just, like, this person has really good hearing and can just, yeah, I'm going to follow these footsteps because I see them walking away from the site. So I'm going to go jog along them for, like, 5 minutes.
It's always footsteps.
It's always footsteps. It's just, like, okay. And then you find them, and then you do a battle or something, or talk to them. And
yeah, because the Detective Vision is, like, an outlier of the fidelity problem. Which is, as game worlds get bigger and more detailed, it's hard to see the actual gamey bits. So developers have to put in a mode that lets you see the gamey bits.
That's fair. But also, they should just stop it because it's stupid. Just let
but
me,
you can fix that with a different art style.
Just let me do pixel hunting, like an old point-and-click adventures, you know? Just, like, I just want to hit
X-Wall. See, but that's the problem.
I'm kidding. I'm totally kidding.
How about actual logic problems rather than just solving the problems for the player?
Yeah, like Oberdin-like logic puzzles would be cool. But, yeah, I mean, like, I really like Judgment, which is a detective game from the Yakuza developers, but, like, the detective stuff in that game is just so scripted and so lame in general. Like, it's just not, it's barely a thing. And that
it's
was, like,
because
one of
people
my
don't
want to
think. They don't want to actually put any thought into the
stupid
problem that they have to solve.
That's stupid. I want to think. Maybe we're the weird ones. We're the only people who want to think when we play games.
Well, yeah, it's dependent on that balance. Like, Sherlock Crimes and Punishment is actually a pretty solid detective game, but that's because it's just a detective game.
Mm-hmm.
Like, one of the things in our list of missions that we would prefer not to have are trailing missions, which actually would make a lot of sense in a detective game. Like, observation while not being seen, which all of that comes back from Assassin's Creed, the first one, which was more of a investigative experience, but very repetitive. So, like, yeah, that's part of the problem. Like, at the end of the day, they want to add some of these other systems, but they also still want to be the open world hacky slash shoot game.
See, that's why I want them to get rid of skill trees as well, because it's not like these skill trees add anything to a AAA game like Tsushima or Horizon Zero Dawn or God of War. It's an illusion of choice, but there is no real choice. You're not building interesting characters out of this, and it's all one very boring giant waste of time.
That's seems fair. I mean, I would argue that Tsushima's skill tree, like, actually demonstrably, like,
changed. Well, you like, end up not unlocking everything eventually.
Yeah, I mean, but I do feel like it feels considerable, but I do think the stance system sucks in that game. Like, it's mm-hmm. it doesn't add anything fresh to the combat. It's just like, oh, I'm facing a shield guy, so I gotta change my stance. But it's like it's only like an animation difference. Like, you're holding your sword at a different place and you're doing different moves, and it's more effective. But you're not hitting any different buttons there, and that's like that's been a frustrating thing. Is like, as I get deeper in the game, is like the combat is very repetitive. The ghost stance has not changed it up that much, so. Yeah, I guess I think I would actually agree that maybe skill trees don't need to be in every game necessarily.
So I'm curious, we've already kind of mentioned that a lot of games are going to be trying to ape The Witcher and that kind of thing. Are there anything else that you fully expect to see in the next generation of RPGs?
That's a big question. I mean, I feel like, honestly, we're just going to, for at least these first few years, we're just going to keep seeing the same shit we've always seen. Like, I don't think I can see the likes of like what Larian Studios has been doing and what Studio Zom, I think, is the Disco Elysium developers. Like, I feel like those games are like developers love those games because they're very systems heavy, they're very like innovative in that respect, but I don't see a lot of AAA developers maybe looking to those and being, I mean, I guess Larian is kind of AAA now, but you know, I don't see a lot of console RPG focused developers looking to like what innovators in the space are doing and being like, I want to do that. Like, I would be stoked if they were, but I feel like they more look at what the market wants, you know, and look at how well Ghost of Tsushima has been selling. And that game's like not, like, it has like a lot of good quality of life improvements, and it's a good time generally, and it has solid storytelling in the side stories, but it's also like very much a checklisty open world game. And like, I guess as we're seeing with like Assassin's Creed Valhalla this fall, like, that nothing in that game seems to be piquing my interest, maybe because I'm not interested in the setting, but it's also, I've played both Odyssey and Origins, so there's a sense of like, I've played this before. So I don't see RPGs really innovating for at least a few more years. Like, maybe mid-generation we'll start seeing really interesting stuff, but I mean, it's like, we still have barely seen Breath of the Wild's influence on like open world and RPG games. So
I mean, if you go back to the beginning of the generation, games like, I think like Dragon Age Inquisition was one of the early biggies, right? Mm-hmm. BioWare was still kind of a thing, and we weren't really anticipating the rise of companies like CD Projekt and Larian. So I fully expect to be surprised by emerging powers in the RPG space, as it were.
I'm curious to see like what Obsidian does now that they're owned by Microsoft and have a budget, you know? Like, Outer Worlds
Playground Games.
Yeah, Playground Fable too. I mean, I'm not a big like Fable. Like, I'm not
either, but I think Playground is an amazing developer.
Oh yeah. Like, they've shown that they do incredible open worlds with the Forza Horizon series. So I'm really curious to see what they do with that. But yeah, I don't see, I guess maybe maybe I do sound cynical too. Like, I just don't see big innovations or big like new things happening with RPGs for a while. I feel like mid-generation, kind of like how Witcher 3 kind of surprised everyone, like, oh wow, this PC only developer made this incredible open world RPG, like, fancy that. And now they're like one of the biggest developers in the world. So I intend to be surprised by probably something along those lines in this generation. Like, I feel like every generation has a few surprises, and Breath of the Wild on its own was surprising. Like, I wouldn't classify that as an RPG, but I would also want to be surprised if RPGs found themselves influenced by Breath of the Wild, like how it structured its open world and how it structured like adventuring in general. Yeah, that's a very long answer, and I don't think it quite answered your question, but I guess like I'm sure we'll be surprised by something, but not anywhere near launch of these consoles.
I'm surprised neither of you brought up the elephant in the room. Destiny likes. The triple. Right.
Destiny doesn't count.
I say that counts. It's an MMO.
It's not an RPG.
But here's the thing.
No, it's not.
Marvel's Avengers is indeed a Destiny-like. It has a single-player RPG component with levels and gear and all of that, while also having a repeatable co-op online combat system. The part that you're missing is Destiny-likes. That's the other road that
RPGs will take. We're already seeing it with a game like Outriders, which looks so criminally boring.
Like, do you think that, like, Dragon Age 4, you've played Inquisition. Inquisition had a multiplayer mode where four people...
Yeah. I don't remember this.
Oh,
it was co-op. It was actually kind
of
cool.
Yeah. I have no memory of this. It was a somewhat decent multiplayer, four-player co-op mode where you could get together four people and go in and attack some monsters and other stuff together. And I don't think for all that Dragon Age 4 will probably try to go back to, like, probably Dragon Age 1 style. I think they'll probably still have some sort of online co-op multiplayer mode. Repeatable as sort of an in-game thing that they can add on to over time.
All right, we have to wrap up, but I think that to end on a positive note, I actually am kind of, I expect developers to be conservative, to go for the Witcher-likes, for the Destiny-likes, that kind of thing, for the games that work. But I think that there are some really interesting innovations coming into gaming pretty soon. One of them is certainly the rise of VR and AR, and I think that there are a lot of really interesting opportunities to be had in the RPG space in that field. I think that the continued advancement of AI could really mean a lot of really interesting thing for RPGs. And then just the fact that the sheer technology is going to result in the ability to create even bigger, more vivid open worlds with like a minimum of loading, like could create a lot of freedom and kind of fantasy worlds that we've never really experienced. And it feels like the love and excitement for RPGs as a genre is at an all-time high at this point. RPGs sell well, they get a lot of excitement, they play well in an era where people want a lot of content for their buck, capital C content.
And
so.
Yakuza is an RPG now. Whoa.
Hell yeah. That's what
yeah, right?
See.
Everything's an RPG because RPGs are the best genre. Okay, guys, thanks for coming on the show, and let's continue on to the track of the week. Okay, thanks to Mike and Katie for coming on the show and making sure that I don't have to talk to myself for the entire episode. All right, let's continue on to the track of the week. Every single week, we go through and we pick a classic track from an RPG that we love because music is so important to the understanding the RPG experience. It really creates a lot of emotions and a lot of feelings and helps drive home the sense of being involved in the world. This week, Nadia is not on the show, so I get to choose whatever the heck I want. So see if you recognize this song. Yeah, of course I had to pick a Super Robot Wars song. Yes, this week's track of the week is Blue Blue Sky from Super Robot Wars Original Generation. It is the main theme of Kruisha, known for taking long baths, and the main heroine of Super Robot Wars Original Generation characters. She is not from any particular giant robot anime. She was created specifically for the series. She was introduced in Super Robot Wars Alpha, where she was one of the generic protagonists, but eventually canonically had a name. I think that Blue Blue Sky is pretty indicative of a lot of the music that you will find in a Super Robot Wars game, and it almost has a synthy PS1 quality to it, or sorry, TurboGrafx-16 quality to it that I really enjoy. It's always very catchy. It's very high tempo, very energetic. It's the kind of music that you want to listen to whenever you go into battle, which is when this music plays. And it is evocative of old school anime in a lot of ways, specifically the mecha genre, which is not surprising because Super Robot Wars Original Generation was composed by Mikiaki Watanabe, who was still churning out tracks at 90 as of 2016. He was born in 1925 and survived World War II. According to the Anime News Network, he said when he was getting ready to compose music for what would otherwise be known as a kid's show, "I kept in mind that I would not compose childish music, even if the target of the dramas was children. That's why people in their 40s and 50s still listen to my songs and sing them at karaoke. I am really pleased." Watanabe was involved in the creation of a lot of classic mecha anthems. He was involved in the composition of, say, Get a Robo. And he also worked on more recent projects like A Boy and His Beast. If you listen to Theme of Z, which mixes a lot of brass with synth, you get an idea of his style and how that was incorporated into Super Robot Wars. Also involved in the music for Super Robot Wars is Jam Project, a musical group that's heavily associated with anime. I may get to them another time. I don't know. I've played Super Robot Wars music a time or two on the show. It is quite simple. It is never that complex, but I think that high energy music that is very catchy and a lot of fun can just put you in a particular mood. In a particular mood to see robots punching one another and using super abilities on each other. Okay, that is the track of the week. We will have another track, as always, next week when we have Nadia back on the show. Let's pick up the mailbag. This week's mail is from Skyward Shadow, and they say, "Cats, these games play it safe comments really helped me understand where she's coming from with her long-standing grumbling, enjoyable grumbling, about the state of the industry. I too feel that we need innovation, but I think there's room for a third option not mentioned. When I play through a game system and or story that I adore, I want more, but I also want it to be better. I recognize that many of my old favorite games had amateur aspects, and I don't want the exact same thing, warts and all. I want the next game to provide a more polished and improved experience. The difference between Suikoden 1 and 2 exemplify this. So Suikoden 3 had taken everything perfect from 2, but then, say, innovated on the weapon system, allowing you to further customize each character, and say it continued to mature the storytelling further. Think of the incredible classic it would be, instead of existing as a controversial entry. We need small innovations in the best games and systems as long as they are genuine and not gimmicky or filler grinds. At the same time, we need truly innovative new products to push the boundaries and explore what's possible." I've been thinking a lot about that, especially when it comes to talking about a game like Ghost of Tsushima, and whether it's always fair to drag a game for not being fresh or interesting or new. And I think that when it comes to innovation, it's not just being able to have completely new ideas that come out of left field and surprise me. I think it's more just not being a cliche. Doing kind of zigging when not zagging, especially when it comes to the storytelling. People expect one thing and then you're like, okay, yeah, like I've seen this a million times before. You're doing it again. Okay, fine, whatever. If it's executed really well, that can be one thing. But I think you're putting yourself in a little bit of a hole when you traffic in well-worn storytelling tropes in particular, or well-worn gameplay tropes. It helps to have a little bit of a twist. Helps to have a little bit of a hook. And a lot of games, I don't know, they're kind of lacking in imagination in that department. They just crib a lot of different elements that kind of work, and then they put them into one big bucket. And that bucket we get is Ghost of Tsushima, a beautiful but deeply cliched game. But, you know, people seem to enjoy it, so who am I to judge, right? Okay, continuing on. Brian Clark says, "I absolutely loved Shin Megami Tensei 4. But yeah, Tokyo can be pretty confusing, mostly because nothing is labeled. Apparently they fixed that in the sequel, Shin Megami Tensei 4 Apocalypse, but I've yet to play it. when I was reviewing SMT4, I got so lost in Tokyo, and I lived in Tokyo. I theoretically knew where Ueno was. I could not find Ueno for the life of me in Shin Megami Tensei 4, which was very, very stressful because I was reviewing it. There were no guides. There was nothing that I could look up. I was eventually able to get help from the PR folks to be able to find where I was supposed to go. See also Dark Souls, a game that, by the way, I don't recommend reviewing without any help from guides and just trying to figure things out while under a deadline. That is stressful as all get out. But yeah, I hope that they fixed it in SMT4 Apocalypse. That is not a game that I played either, but it tends to be fairly well regarded among RPG purists. So perhaps the Blood God recommends it. And finally, Drinking with Skeleton says, "My biggest concern about the Nocturne remaster is all the quality of life improvements they've added to the series over time. I tried to revisit Nocturne after loving SMT4, but the glacial pace of combat, uncompromising difficulty, and the general system regressions made it a short trip." Yeah, that's part of the reason that Nocturne did not make it into our top 25 RPGs, despite the fact that it has a large and very loyal fan base. It is kind of a bear to play. Atlas doesn't generally skimp on re-releases, but I hope they aren't so married to Nocturne's reputation as a hardcore classic that they don't make it more accessible and generally fun to play. I would not be surprised if they went and enhanced Nocturne systems, added a bunch of quality of life improvements, not the least because they're already enhancing the graphics. This is not a straight port. So I could see plenty of development time being given to making Nocturne maybe a game that's more enjoyable to play and perhaps gets people excited to play SMT5, which is another game that's coming along. Then again, maybe Atlas is just like, what, SMT? It's the hardcore series. This is a hardcore series for hardcore fans. If you want something a little more accessible, play Persona. Otherwise, deal with it. That is all of our questions for the week, and I think that it is time to wrap up. Axe and Blood God is a US Gamer podcast. You can find us on iTunes, Stitcher, wherever podcasts are sold. Thanks to Mike and Katie for coming on the show and talking about what we want to see in next-gen RPGs. It was a very enjoyable conversation, and we will have Nadia back next week to continue on with the exploration of the RPG genre. We're going to continue our console RPG quest. Next week is the Nintendo DS, one of the most important consoles in RPG history, certainly in terms of handhelds. It's weird. I sort of feel like we don't talk about the DS as much as we should, but it is one of the top-selling handheld consoles of all time, and there are some real classics on that thing. So we're going to have a really in-depth conversation next week. But until then, for Katie and Mike and myself, thanks for listening and happy adventuring.